And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Earl H. from Oceanside.
Hi, everybody. My name's Earl, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'll be your lower companion for this evening. First and foremost, I'd like to thank Lori for asking me to come down and speak tonight. It's always an honor to speak and help carry the message of recovery. And I love being sober. I love being in an AA meeting this evening. And welcome to the newcomers. I know one of you. Welcome back. Please stay. I'm not going to tell you to keep coming back. I'm going to just stay. And for the other new folks as well, I hope you're feeling really, really desperate. Because that's what it took for me to finally surrender to this program. Congratulations to the birthday girls. That's awesome. And I think we had a 90-day. Congratulations on that. And I just love the 10-minute speaker. Yeah? We got married for better or for worse. She couldn't do any worse, and I couldn't do any better. Yeah? And I just love you to death. Thank you so much. I guess I should give you the particulars. I've got a sobriety date. It's October the 16th, 1987. And it took me 18 months after going through rehab to get that sobriety date because I was rather delusional and full of denial. And as they say in more about alcoholism, I was trying every form of argument to prove to you that I was different and I wasn't an alcoholic. I just had this minor problem with this white powdery substance known as powdered alcohol. You all know what it is. So in the beginning, my home group originally was the Dunsmore Group in La Crescenta, California. I got sober in that clubhouse. It's the oldest clubhouse west of the Mississippi. It was started in August of 1949, and a great bunch of people that helped me when I got there. My home group today is the San Marcos Speakers in Vista, California. And we moved down here about 10 years ago. A lot of friends in the meeting tonight. It's a good turnout for a Saturday night. Thank you for coming out and supporting me. And I need all the help I can get, you know. In the beginning, I never felt a part of, and I felt less than. And it's true because that was the reality. I was always really small for my age growing up. I think I was like 3.5 feet tall until I was 12. And I was a little self-conscious about that, and I would compensate for that by using inappropriate language and kind of showing off. To make me better, you know, that you would accept me. So, anyway, I had a pretty good childhood. I had loving parents. They were heavy drinkers, but not too dysfunctional, pretty normal. I didn't want for anything. But I remember, I guess it was about 14 or 15, I had this Colt 45 malt liquor handed to me, and I downed that baby, and boy, It felt really, really good. And I liked the taste of it. And it talks about it in the doctor's opinion is that we like to drink because of the effect produced in us. And it had that effect. All of a sudden, I wasn't so short. I wasn't so shy. I could dance better. I could do everything. I had this, like, confidence. And I continued to go after that. Now, a lot of my peers back in those days, they started drinking and drugging out of two main reasons. Curiosity. I wonder what that feels like. They're over there. They're laughing. They're having a good time. I'm curious as to what that's like. And the fact that you will disregard all of the good advice your parents ever gave you and you'll do anything with your peer group to be accepted. You know, we're all going to go over to Sunset Cliffs and jump into the ocean tonight. Let's go. You know, I want to be a part of. I want you to accept me. And that's how it kind of starts out. In my case, I'm the abnormal drinker. In the beginning, okay? And normal people, they get drunk or they get high, and the next day they come to and they get on with their lives. They've satisfied that curiosity, and it really doesn't do for them what it does for me. It's my solution, literally and figuratively, it's a solution. And so I immediately want to replicate that experience because it makes me feel okay. It makes me feel a part of. And in the beginning, it's just a little bit of trouble and a whole lot of fun. And consequently, that's the way it went. I became a party boy. And I had a lot of fun. But I crossed this line. Actually, I think I snorted it, but I crossed this line from recreation and curiosity to I can't deal with life. I don't know where I want to go to college. I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. I don't want to deal with any of that. I just want to get high and party. And that's what I did for most of my junior and senior year. I took a lot of outside issues. Excuse me. Still thirsty after all these years. So, I wound up going off into that deep end. And by the time I was 21 years of age, I'd been arrested a half a dozen times, and I was unable to deal with my public defender on the last one. I had, just previous to that, I had gotten a young lady pregnant and did not, she was 16, I was 19 about that time, and we put the child up for adoption because we weren't suitable parents, and thank God that we did that. And so she got prenatal vitamins and counseling and care and love, and I got loaded. That's how I dealt with the guilt and the shame and the pain, as I tried to numb myself to that. And so I didn't deal with my public defender. I was acting a little strange in court, and they decided that they should probably send me away for some observation. So you all know what a 5150 is. Well, a 1370 in that same code book says that they can observe me for as long as they need to. And so the court sent me up there for an evaluation. And upon arrival there, I informed them that I was the second coming of Christ. And they immediately slammed me down on the floor, pulled my pants down, and started giving me injections of stelazine, thorazine, marazine, and other antipsychotic medications. The state of California has some of the best drugs. But anyway, they put me in 4-point restraints, and I was in really bad shape. And I have scars on my wrists from turning in those leather restraints and burning blisters into my wrist. That's what drinking did for me. So anyway, long story short, I finally cooperated with the psychiatric technicians. I told the head psychiatrist what he wanted to hear, and they sent me back to court after 6 months, and I went before the judge, and he goes, time served, 3 years probation, which is what I would have given you had you merely cooperated originally. But, you know, I had to live One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And that was quite an experience. But just before I got out of there, I was having these visions, and I'm going, you know, when I get out, I'm going to get a good job, and I'm going to get a good girl, and I'm going to be a good father, and I'm going to get the house with the white picket fence and the pickup truck and all the right toys and everything, and my life's going to be really good. And I set out to do that. And I accomplished much of that, except for the fact that I have what's described in the second chapter of the big book, There Is a Solution. I didn't know I had a spiritual malady at the time. Okay, and so I was trying to bring all these things from the outside in to make me feel okay. And I wasn't able to do that. So I would go back to the substance again. And that would make me feel okay. So I did a lot. But, you know, it was going to be, I was going to control and enjoy it this time. I was just going to drink beer and smoke a little marijuana like God intended. And I'd get to lay off all that other stuff. And that plan worked for a while. I got married. I took a hostage. That lasted about 11 months. got out of that marriage. Got this great job at the phone company where I went to work in an office with 120 women, and there were only 6 guys, okay? And 2 of those guys were gay. So my odds were really, really good. And I met who I thought was Miss Right now. She had all the correct qualifications. She was pretty, and she said yes. Yeah. And that marriage lasted about, well, we were technically married for about 4.5 years, but I don't think she ever was in love with me. We had a son. And I loved being a dad, and he was different. Didn't quite know why he was different or how he was different necessarily, other than he behaved kind of strangely. And at the time, my mom was concerned about it, and I took him to a best pediatrician in Southern California, and they said, he's got an incredibly high IQ, but other than that, we don't see anything clinically wrong with him. Turns out he was autistic, mildly autistic, and he had Asperger's. So there was these challenges in the marriage, and I'm saying that we need to do something, and she's saying, oh, there's nothing wrong with him. He'll grow out of it, blah, blah, blah. So just before Christmas of 1979, she asked me if it wouldn't be too much trouble if I would move out by January 1st. Merry Christmas. So, you know, I had no problem leaving her, but it broke my heart to leave that boy. because I had really bonded and loved him very, very much. And I liked being married, and I wasn't, you know, I would drink a little bit, and I would, you know, hold down a job, be responsible, pay my bills. I wasn't getting into trouble. But again, here I'm faced with a lot of pain and a lot of shame, and so I do what I know will fix that, and I'll have a little more to drink and a little more to smoke and whatever else you got. And so 1980s start off, and you know, I'm free again, and I'm brokenhearted because I see this boy every other weekend starting on a Friday night at 6 o'clock, and I have to have him back on a Sunday night at 6 o'clock, okay? And that's how often I get to see him. And I also get to make payments. They call it child support. And so, you know, that caused me a lot of pain and so forth. Anyway, I was introduced to this Peruvian marching powder. And it instantly did for me that nothing else could, and it allowed me to drink a lot more. And I thought it was great. It was a lot of fun. I finally got that great job at the phone company. I got promoted into some good stuff, and I got to install some phones for Jackson Browne at a recording studio in downtown. I got to hang out with those guys, and boy, do they know how to party. And you know, it was, and again, it was a lot of fun and just a little bit of trouble. And anyway, that went on for about 3 years, where I was a very social kind of person, and then all of a sudden it got really, really dark, and I realized I had a really bad problem, and so I had a moment of weakness. Some people would say it was a moment of clarity. I went into rehab. And I was introduced to the 12 steps. And I looked at those steps, and I said, no, I can't do that. I'm way too hip, slick, and cool. But by the time I got to rehab, there was a lot of trouble in my life. I was not coming home on the weekends. Oh, by the way, I married again. And took three hostages this time. She had two boys, and their fathers weren't participating in their life, and so, you know, I was a good fit. I would pick a fight with her on a Friday morning on my way to work, which allowed me to justify me staying out all weekend until Sunday night. And I, you know, I this got to be a pattern. It got to be a real problem. And so, you know, one night I just didn't know what I was going to tell her, but I had to get home and I had to get showered and I had to try to get a little bit of sleep and get back to work on Monday. And so back in those days, they didn't have cell phones, but they had these pagers, and she was burning up my pager. She ran the battery completely dead in it, and so I call her on this payphone, and I don't really know what I'm going to tell her, but I look down, and there's a newsstand right there, and there's a headline in the paper, and Ronald Reagan had just bombed Libya. And she answered the phone, and I said, honey, you may not believe this, but I was kidnapped by Libyan terrorists. And to prove to you that this is a family disease, she said, oh, I'm just happy you're safe. Please come home. Now, in all fairness, she was very unhappy with my recreational use of all of these things. But in full disclosure, on our first date, I offered her alcohol, cocaine, and marijuana, and she fully was okay with it. But for some reason, after we got married and she wanted me to be a father and a husband and come home, you know, that was a problem. So anyway, I went into rehab, and I was introduced to the recovery program. And I spent the first 18 months trying to disprove everything that you were telling me. And I finally had to get miserable enough to do it somebody else's way. And so I waved the white flag. And, you know, surrender is not so much an issue of admitting defeat, although it is admitting defeat. The real thing is coming over to the winning side, where they'll take care of you. And so that's what they did. And these people opened up their arms and they took me in, and I got into the steps, and I got into the literature, and I got into service. And slowly the obsession to drink and use left me, and I began to want what they had. And my life changed so much for the better, so much for the better. Now, I wish I could tell you that everything got wonderful and that they rolled out the red carpet and they lined it with rose petals and my life has been fantastic ever since. But that's just not the way life is. And so I was getting promotions at work because I was, you know, showing up. Clear-headed and not hungover. And my relationship with my son and my two stepsons was getting a lot better because I was focused and spending time with them. I started coaching junior All-American football and Little League, and I was engaged, and that was all good. But this marriage that I was in, number three, it started out in the disease of alcoholism, and the marriage never recovered. All that bad behavior took its toll. And of course, remember, I've got the spiritual malady, but I haven't really changed the behavior about bringing stuff in to make it okay. So, you know, she got the Mercedes, she got a lot of nice jewelry, nice clothes, trip to Europe, nice vacations. I was making up for all that bad behavior, but the bottom line was, is that if you don't love me, I can't make you love me. And she had fallen out of love with me, and she was having an affair. And so that marriage came to an end. And during that time, I had this 18-year-old son who had the Asperger's, and his mom had done a geographic and moved to Northern California. So instead of seeing him every other weekend, I was only seeing him a couple times a year for vacation time and so forth. We spoke on the phone, but if you're familiar with the disease of Asperger's, it's very, very difficult for them to socialize and to open up in those conversations. So he was having some issues with his mom, arguing with his mom, and his mom went to Lake Tahoe one weekend and left him home with his grandmother, and he went into her nightstand and took out a revolver and put it to his head and pulled the trigger. And I got a call from the Butte County Sheriff's Office, and they informed me that it seemed like there was an apparent suicide and that he had committed suicide. And that was totally unacceptable. Totally unacceptable. At that point, I was 8 years sober. I'd been sponsoring men. I had a sponsor. I was deep into service. Why did you do this to me, God? I thought I was doing the deal. How come you're not keeping this thing up? How come you're not keeping your side of the bargain up? And the tough part of that was not 1 month before, my mom died suddenly. And I hadn't even finished processing the grief of losing my mother, and then I lost my son. And I had to get some extra tools. I had, thank God for sponsors. Thank God for sponsorship. My sponsor and I spent a lot of time together. We just rode around in his Suburban. And we drove up to the Malibu and the beach, and we just talked. And I would just talk, and I'd throw up emotionally and on and on. And he was just there for me. He didn't have any answers, but he had two ears, and he was a good listener. Because the answers that I was seeking, there are none. There is no why. There is no reason why this sort of thing happens. So I got some grief counseling, and I got some extra tools because grief isn't the disease. The steps are fantastic tools for working on your disease of alcoholism, but grief is a different animal. And the loss of a child is a much different thing to go through. So anyway, we moved through that, and then the marriage blew up, and now I'm 12 years sober, and I'm going to get a divorce, third divorce. She's going to get half of everything because that's what she's entitled to. There's a big difference between what you deserve and what you're entitled to. The entitlement part has to do with the legality of it. The deserving part has to do with my resentment of it. And so, you know, I'm 52 years of age, and I'm follically inclined. Nobody's going to love me. Nobody's going to want me. I've been through three marriages. I'm going to be damaged goods. And so, I'm in that horrible spot of, I think they call it, when God closes one door, he opens another. Well, believe me, it's hell in the hallway. Because I need to know what the future holds for me. I need all the answers right now. I need to be in control. You know, I don't know if you can relate to that, but you know, and the thing is I had to move into acceptance. I had to accept the reality for what it was. And, you know, the reason why divorce is so expensive is because it's worth it. I was full of a lot of fear. I was full of a lot of fear. And I just had to walk through it. And the beauty of it is that I had all these crazy sponsees and a sponsor, and that kept me out of my head. You know, it made me think about other problems besides my own. And that's the beauty of this program, is that it is a we program. We do this thing together. I cannot stay sober on my own. And if you take the word illness and you take I out of that word and you replace it with we, it becomes wellness. Okay? I can't do this thing by myself. I need you. I still need these crazy sponsees in my life today. You know? I am so grateful for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've been through the steps a few times. I've taken a lot of men through the steps. And when I take these other guys through the steps, guess what? I get dragged through the steps again. And that is such a huge benefit to me because I keep learning little bits more about my inner workings and a little bit more about me when I hear it being shared with me. I know the first three steps are about me and my relationship with God, and 4 through 9 is me and my relationship with me. And 10, 11, and 12 is my relationship and how I deal with you, okay? And the steps have saved my life, okay? Being in action has saved my life. What this process gave me was a relationship with a power greater than myself. The book talks about it. Lack of power was my dilemma. You know, for 37 years, I managed it. The proper description would be I mismanaged it really bad. You know, 3 failed marriages, a lot of it my own doing, you know. Yeah, I did that inventory, and yeah, there were a lot of people that screwed me over, but I had a part in it. And this process that we go through allows me to clean up my part of that. And especially when we get into 6 and 7, and those defects of character that they kick my butt constantly, okay? But what I found through doing a lot of work in 6 and 7, which, by the way, gets one paragraph in the big book. I mean, that was, boy, they led a lot up to our imagination there in 1939 when they did that. But when I do those 2 steps, I have to be willing to let go, okay? And I have to be humbly ask God to remove this defect of character, which was all of my survival skills back before I got sober, in the moment that I'm about to do it. I still have every character defect I walk through the room with, into the rooms with. They have not been removed from me. They've been removed from my use in the moment that I do it. And that's because I have substituted that with a principle. There's principles behind all of these steps. And in the 12th step, it talks about practicing these principles in all of our affairs. I miss that fine print. You know, the first 12 years of my sobriety, I was controlling and managing my career, my kids, my marriage. It worked really good on my marriage. All my affairs, I missed that part. And once I started doing that, all those other areas got fixed. Because I have to practice honesty, and I have to have hope, faith, and courage. And I have to have integrity. And I have to have willingness and and humility and discipline and awareness and service. And those are just 12. There are a lot more principles. And I love the traditions. The traditions are fantastic. The first 5 traditions are affirmations. These are what we should be doing as a group. The 7 are renunciations. Those are the things that we shouldn't be doing because it's bad for the group. I learned that from the old timers, sitting in meetings, studying the literature. I've been blessed with this program of recovery. I got to do service work. I was on the board of trustees of my Alano Club in 1999 when the club turned 50. And what an honor that was to be entrusted with that. And it got me involved. Service got me 2 of the guys sitting in the row back here, good friends of mine in San Diego when I was living up in L.A., met him in service work. Lori, met you in service work. I've known Lori for 20 years. I've met so many wonderful people in this program doing service work, just trying to give it back. And they say in that tradition that our primary purpose is to carry the message. Well, what's the message? For me, it's chapter 2. There is a solution. You do this work, you have a spiritual experience, you're put in touch with a power greater than yourself that will solve all of your problems. You just have to surrender to that. Every day I surrender to that. I ask God for direction. Okay? And sometimes it's plain as can be, and sometimes it's a mystery to me. But I go into the book. And what's God's, what's my purpose today, God? Well, it's in the 80s. If you're into the book, it's in the pages in the 80s, right? I pause when agitated. Upon awakening, you know, I take a moment out. I think about the day ahead. I do the inventory work on a daily basis. That's so mean that step 10, that's like a trick. That's the trick question step. where, oh, by the way, you're going to be doing 4 through 9 for the rest of your life on a daily basis, okay? If you want to do something about changing what's screwed up, you know. And it doesn't say, you know, if I am wrong. It says when I am wrong. I promptly admit it. And I try and take care of it as quickly as possible. And I try to look at the character defect behind what caused me to do that. And usually it's fear. You know, fear and pride. Fear and pride. Page 40, was it 49 in the 12 and 12? I think it's mentioned like 16 times. I think I might have an issue with fear and pride. You know, I ask God every day for the power to help somebody to stay sober and to try and not have to get even the score, insist that I know the answer, you know, control it. You know, just let it go and see how it turns out. That's what I'm supposed to do. I would like to acknowledge my fourth wife. Now, I'm the luckiest man in the room, by far. By doing H&I service, I met this gal, and I knew her parents for 12, 14 years before I met her. I knew her parents in the rooms, and her father was a DEA agent, and it was hilarious because when we got together, I was on the board of trustees for Cocaine Anonymous. DEA and Cocaine Anonymous, that didn't sound like a very, you know, what's up with that? But I got to tell you, he was a great man. You know, he spent the first part, half of his life putting guys like me in prison. But he spent the second half of his life helping guys like us stay out of prison. He gave back what was so freely given to him, and he was of service, and he was a great man. And I love your parents. And you know, today, the internet is weird. What, I got five? Got about five? The internet is a weird thing. You can go on Google now and find stuff out that used to take days and days of going through documents and registers and so forth to get that information. That boy I gave up for adoption, he hunted me down on the internet. And he sent me a letter. And it came from Vienna, Austria, and it had a newspaper clipping about my father, my birth father, Earl Andrew Hazen Jr., about he was a photojournalist and an airline pilot for the newspaper, and he died in an airplane crash. So he had a photocopy of that newspaper article in there, and he goes, "Would you happen to be the Earl Andrew Henderson whose father, blah, 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 blah?" And I'm going, man, I've inherited a lot of money. The long-lost millionaire from Europe in the castle in Vienna. You know? Boy, the life is going to be good. And if you are, please email me back. Yes, and I email him back. I sent an email out on... and responded, and I go, "Yes, I am. How can I help you?" And he said, and he responded, and he goes, "This may be very disturbing, and if you don't want to go forward with this, I understand, because it can be very disruptive, but I am your son." And he basically was reaching out to me. He was adopted into a fabulous family. They nurtured him. He excelled. He graduated at the top of his class in law school, University of Hawaii. He clerked for a district judge for a year. He did really, really well. And so we started going back and forth, and I'd send him all these pictures and family history and medical history, and he'd send me all the kinds of pictures. Anyway, we never spoke on the phone And we never spoke to each other until the day he knocked on my door and came to visit me for 3 days. And I got to meet my granddaughter and his wife, and it was absolutely mind-boggling. And what a gift from God that we were able to reconnect. And that would have never happened had I had not surrendered to this program and gotten sober. Believe me, if I had stayed out there in the late 80s doing what I was doing, you'd have a different speaker tonight for sure. I'd be pushing up daisies at Forest Lawn. And so, and you know, those the two boys in that I was a stepfather to, I have a better relationship with them today than, it's unbelievable. We're very, very loving and close. I adopted both those boys, and one of them's an LA City fireman. He works on a hazmat team, and I have this wonderful stepdaughter that I got as a result of being married to you, and life is really, really good today. Yeah, we've got challenges. You know, we've got life is definitely in session. But, you know, we've got tools to deal with it, and we don't have to do anything alone, you know. The only time that I'm alone is when I choose to be alone. And, you know, I just want to close by saying that if you're new here, give this program a shot. Even if your mind tells you that, you know, it ain't going to work, the disease lies to us. It lied to me for 18 months before I surrendered. And thank God I finally surrendered. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. And so just hang out. And sponsorship, it's so important. If you don't have a sponsor, get one, okay? And if you get one, use them. Because sponsors are like condoms. They're only effective if you use them.